Today is the 27th of July, 1994, and I want to take up now on this third tape of material on the upper level tech of Trom. I want to take up this subject of sensations. This tape, in common with its predecessor, shouldn't be, must not be separated from the remainder of the set. The word sensation is one of those words that when you look it up in the dictionary you rapidly wish that you hadn't. It's one of those words that the dictionary doesn't really help you very much on. The further you look it up in the dictionary, the more confused you tend to become. I suppose the best definition of a sensation that we can find in English would be a sensation is that which is sensed. That which is sensed. A sensation is that which is sensed. But unfortunately you won't find that definition in the dictionary. As a person works with the exercises of Trom, they sooner or later become aware of something on the subject of sensations. And this something can be best expressed as the following: that sensation is generated at the boundary between opposition postulates in games play. Now, I've just checked that back. It's not garbled, so I won't repeat it. Now, if you know about that, if you know that about a sensation, you probably know more about sensations than anyone else does, because that is a very, very fundamental datum about sensations. Very, very fundamental datum. The sensation is generated at the boundary between opposing postulates in games play. Now, that proposition leads us to a definition of a sensation. We could actually define a sensation in Trom as saying that a sensation is that which is generated at the boundary between opposition postulates in games play. And that would be a very good definition of a sensation. And it's a far, far better definition of a sensation than you will ever find in any dictionary. A far, far better definition. It's a better definition simply because it's a more usable, it's a more practical definition than what you will find in a dictionary. It does actually help you, and it doesn't confuse you. It actually solves confusion rather than adding to your confusion. Let's go through the definition a bit and take it apart and see if we can learn something by just examining the definition. First, we have this subject of that sensation is generated at the boundary. Generated. Now, that tells you that sensation is not created in games play, it's generated in games play. And it's generated at the boundary. Well, boundary's obvious enough, at the boundary between opposition postulates. Well, we know what opposition postulates are. We know of the goals packages, and we can define an opposition postulate. So we know what an opposition postulate is. That which is generated at the boundary between opposition postulates in games play. Now, this is the way it works out. This is the way it appears to be, and this is our simplest look at this subject of sensation. That as soon as you separate yourself, as soon as you separate the universe into the classes of self and not self, and you occupy the class of self, and this is all done with postulates. And as soon as you achieve this state of self, then you look across at the class of not self and notice the postulates over there. That any slightest opposition postulate that you put up to what you perceive over to a postulate in the class of not self, a sensation will be generated at the boundary between those two postulates. If you can get that, you understand what sensation is. It's something which occurs at the boundary there between a postulate and its opposition postulate. It's something which occurs at the boundary when the classes of self and not self are in conflict with each other. In strict fact, unless the postulates are complementary, unless the two postulates involved a complementary postulate, some sensation will be generated at the boundary between the postulates. It may be a very light sensation, very, very tenuous sensation, but only when the postulates are complementary is no sensation generated at the boundary between them. And now that's about as close as we can get. If the two postulates are not complementary postulates, then there's always the possibility of sensation being generated at the boundary between them. And if the postulates are opposing postulates, as they become more and more direct oppositions, more and more correct oppositions, I should say, more and more correctly oppose each other, so the sensation becomes more and more pronounced and more obvious. Now, this tells us right away that sensation is a phenomena of games play. It's a phenomena of games play. In the absence of games, we don't get this subject of sensation. In the no-game state, there is no sensation. There's no sensation in the no-game state. You have to be in a game state. In one of the games conditions, you have to be either a non-compulsive, a voluntary games player, or a compulsive games player, or in the insanity state, to be sensing any form of sensation. That simply has to be this class of self and the class of the unit. You have to have divided the universe into the class of self and not self in order to generate sensations. In other words, there's got to be a games condition there. So sensation is a phenomena of games play, and that is absolutely fundamental. Out of the confusion. Now, I mentioned, say, that sensation is generated at the boundary between opposing postulates in games play. The question immediately arises is that can a spiritual being create sensation? The answer to that is yes. Obviously, a spiritual being can create anything. But a spiritual being can only create sensation when he knows what he's creating. It's like anything else. You've got to know what you're creating before you can create it. You've got to know what it is before you can mock it up. And it's quite useless for a spiritual being to attempt to create sensation without understanding its anatomy. When he understands its anatomy, he can create it. But until he understands its anatomy or what it consists of, he won't have any success in creating it. The great joker in the pack, of course, is there is a joker in the pack here, that at the point where he understands the anatomy of the sensation, and so can create the sensation, he has no need to create the sensation because he has no desire to create it. So there's some ramifications here to the subject of learning what the anatomy of sensation is. In other words, it's not as simple as it might appear. I mean, a man might say, "Well, marvellous! If I take up Trom, I can learn the anatomy of sensations, and then I'll be able to create sexual sensation, and then I won't have to go down to a brothel every Saturday night and spend all my money in a brothel. You see, I'll be able to mock up all this sexual sensation." Well, the joker there is that by the time he knows all about sexual sensation, there's various things he has to do before he will get into this state Well, the time he gets into the state of being able to first of all knowingly generate the sense, the sexual sensation, and then mock it up simply as a postulate configuration or whatever it consists of, its anatomy, to create its anatomy, he's long past any desire spiritually to spend his Saturday nights inhabiting a brothel. You see that? You can think of far, far more interesting things to do with his time on a Saturday night than spend it in a brothel. In other words, he's had a case change, and his change of case will change his ideas on these things. So when you walk this route towards the understanding of sensations and the creation of sensations, do understand that it can produce some considerable changes to your life. Now, moving on, one of my original earliest discoveries on the subject of sensations, working with the goals package, when I was working with the goals packages, was this discovery that the sensation generated in any particular goals package is peculiar to that goals package. Now that is a very, very interesting discovery. Very interesting discovery. That that every goals package, the sensation generated between the opposition postulates in any goals package, the sensation is peculiar to that goals package. In other words, you take the to know goals package, the sensations generated between the opposing postulates in that goals package are peculiar to that goals package, and similarly for the to eat goals package would have its own particular sensation, and the to help goals package would have its own particular sensations, and so on across the boards. That the sensations are every goals package has its own peculiar sensations that are generated between the opposition legs in that goals package. Now, this fundamental discovery was quickly followed by another discovery, which is a much more important discovery, and that is that the sensation that can be generated in a goals package can be generated by occupying any one of the four legs of that goals package and simply creating that the postulate in that leg of the goals package and opposing it to its opposition postulate in the environment. Now, to give you an example of that, if you wish to generate sexual sensation in games play, now that the sexual sensation is peculiar to sex goals package. You don't find sexual sensation in the to eat goals package or in the to know goals package. It's peculiar to the to sex goals package. And if you wish to generate that sensation in life, in games play, you can take any one of the postulates, of the four postulates of the to sex goals package. In other words, you could occupy the to take the to sex postulate and create that postulate, put yourself into that class and say, right, well, I'm going to create the to sex postulate, and providing you can get someone out over that way to oppose you with a to not be sexed postulate, providing only that, then you can generate sexual sensation with a to sex postulate. Similarly, you can generate sexual sensation with a to not sex postulate, providing you can get someone over that way in the class of not self to oppose your to not self to not sex postulate with a to be sex postulate. Or you can generate sexual sensation by mocking up a in the class of self a to be sexed postulate and providing you can get somebody, an opponent over that way, to oppose you with a to not sex wrestler. Or, and finally, you can generate sexual sensation by mocking up a to not be sex postulate and opposing it to someone over that way who is directing a to sex postulate at you. So you've got, there's four ways in the goals package, there's four options you have, there's four ways you can create this sexual sensation. Now that is a tremendously interesting datum. That is a tremendously interesting datum. And when you start to think about that, something very, very fundamental occurs. There's a very, very valuable, very, very important datum immediately is deducible from that state of affairs. And that is, and this important datum is, that if this is so, if the sensation is peculiar, first of all, if the sensation is peculiar to the goals package, and it can be generated by occupying any leg of the goals package in opposition to its opposition postulate in the environment, in the class of not self, you can generate this sensation by occupying any one of the four legs of the goals package and opposing it, getting it and opposing it to its opposition posture in the environment, then it follows that the sensation being generated must only consist of the four postulates of that goals package. Now this is one of those datums that once you grasp it, you know, the penny suddenly dropped and you say, oh my God, why didn't I think of that before? It's obvious. You take, say, the to set goals package. If you can generate this sensation by occupying any one of those four legs in the package, all you require is the opposition postulate to the postulate you're occupying. All you require is that somebody over that way is going to oppose your postulate, in other words. And you can generate this sensation by using any one of those four postulates. Then the sensation itself that you are generating can only consist of the four postulates of the six goals package. If you think about it, it's obvious. It's obvious. I mean, if you've got a to sex postulate sitting in space and it's opposed by a to not be sex postulate, and at the boundary between them we have this thing called sexual sensation being generated, right? Then we have a to be sex postulate and a to not sex postulate sitting there, and between them we find that there's sexual sensation being generated, and it's the same sensation that was being generated as was being generated between the other two postulates. Well, this thing that's being generated, this sensation being generated, can only consist of some configuration of the four postulates of the to sex goals package. See, we've already know that the sexual sensation is peculiar to the goals package. We know that. That was the first discovery. Then we find out that it can be generated from any one of the four legs of the package. Oh, therefore, the sensation, it follows logically that the sensation must consist and can only consist of the four postulates of the goals package in a particular postulate configuration. And it's our job to find out what this configuration is. If we can discover what this configuration is, we then know the anatomy of the sensation. Do you get that? The anatomy of the sensation then, in a particular goals package, is simply a matter of determining what is the postulate configuration that occurs at the boundary between the opposition postulates. There's some configuration of postulates there, and this configuration consists of all four postulates of the goals package. No more, no less. It's not those four postulates plus other things. No, no, it's exactly, that is, the four postulates of the goals package are necessary and sufficient to produce the sensation. Get it? Now, this might be a new idea to you, this idea that the thing, a sensation, can actually only consist of postulates. That its anatomy can be entirely a matter of postulates. That its total existence is subject to postulates. Now this is unusual. This is maybe it's a new thought to you, but nevertheless you're going to have to come to grips with this idea. Unfortunately, a part of our general philosophy in the West, and this philosophy has been continued in the subject of Scientology, is the idea is to separate out mass from postulates, to keep them to separate and distinct classes. In other words, it's in Scientology we have the idea that you can mock things up with a postulate. You make a postulate to create, and you create something, and that which you create may be a mass. See, so the mass is the result of a postulate, but the idea of a mass, or whatever it is, a creation consisting of a postulate, now that's something new. Now that's something you have to get to wrap your mind around. That's a new idea, and it can be a new idea to many people who listen to this or who come to grips with this material in Tron for the first time. It's a new thought. It's a new idea. But nevertheless, it's one that you're going to have to come to grips with, as will become very, very obvious as we proceed. So just bear with me for the moment with this idea that the idea that what you would normally regard as a mass or as an energy manifestation or as a manifestation of particles, a sensation, a thing, may simply consist entirely of postulates in a certain configuration. By configuration, I mean a pattern. A configuration, a pattern. Another way to look at it would be to say that, well, if this is so, then the actuality is the postulates, and the illusion is the mass, or the energy, or the sensation. You see that? One perceives the illusion, but the actuality is the postulates, and the particular postulates of the goals package in a certain configuration. Okay, now let's see how this can come about. In order to find out how this can come about, it's necessary for us to imagine a game situation. And that's all that's necessary for us to do, is to imagine a game situation, that then to see how this can come about and see how this can occur. Let's imagine a person in the general case occupying a game situation using postulate X. Here we're going to use the XY postulate set, our general XY postulate set, our general case. We have one person occupying and using, occupying an identity that's using the postulate X. And his opposition postulate is the postulate 1 minus y. Okay? Now, the person is directing this postulate towards his x postulate, towards the opponent, and the opponent is directing the 1 minus y postulate towards him. Now, the two postulates are going out, and somewhere between these two identities, call them A and B, we have A using an X postulate And B, the identity B is using a 1 minus Y postulate. And somewhere between the two of them, the two postulates, the X postulate and the 1 minus Y postulate, are going to meet. Now here we have what is technically known as a boundary conditions. These are boundary conditions. And we have to go in and find out exactly what is going on under these boundary conditions. Now let's take it from the viewpoint of the X postulate. Let's take it from the viewpoint of the X postulate. The X postulate goes out and meets the 1 minus Y postulate. Well now, the purpose, the intention of the 1 minus Y postulate is to do what? It's to drive this X postulate into 1 minus X. You get that? In other words, that is what the 1 minus Y postulate is trying to do. To drive X into 1 minus X. If the 1 minus Y postulate succeeds completely across the boards, then the person in identity A will change his postulate from X to 1 minus X, and then the postulate configuration that maintains will be 1 minus Y and 1 minus X, which are complementary postulates, signifying an overwhelm and the end of the game. Remember, our set is an XY set. It's got two complementary postulates in it. It's got XY, a complementary postulate, and it's got 1 minus X, 1 minus Y. I'm ignoring the brackets here for the moment. 1 minus X, 1 minus Y is the other pair of complementary postulates. So if the 1 minus Y postulate the purpose of the 1 minus Y is to drive X into 1 minus X, and so overwhelm X and drive X into 1 minus X and create the end of game situation, complementary postulates, 1 minus Y, 1 minus X, okay? But let's imagine that the situation is a stable situation. In other words, the boundary is stable. It's staying at the same distance from A as it is from B, or not? No, it's not moving. It's not, the boundary is not moving towards A, and it's not moving towards B. It's staying at its position. In other words, it's a static situation. But nevertheless, the postulates are still going out, and the boundary is there. There is this collision between these opposition postulates, which is the boundary. Okay, can you imagine that? Right, well now, what is going to happen to this this X postulate? Well, let us imagine a little tiny parcel of an X postulate as it approaches the boundary. This is rather like when you're working with differential calculus, when you take a little tiny section. When you remember the old proof of differential calculus there. Well, this is very very similar. You take a little parcel, an infinitely tiny parcel of X postulate, and as this tiny parcel of postulate goes towards the boundary, it comes more and more under the influence of the 1 minus Y postulate on the other side of the boundary. And there's two forces acting upon this little parcel. There's the force behind it, which is driving it into the X, holding it and driving it into X. And there's the force from the other side of the boundary, the opposition force, which is driving it into 1 minus X. And this little parcel gets closer and closer until it's right up against the boundary, until the 1 minus Y postulate is facing it, driving it inexorably into 1 minus X. But behind it, there's the games player A driving with the X postulate. So the little parcel is being held in X, but being driven into 1 minus X. So inevitably, at the limit, when the limit occurs, at the limiting point, the postulate, the ex-postulate bonds to the 1 minus x. At a certain point on the, or put it another way, at a certain point on the boundary, the 1 minus y is going to drive a little parcel of x postulate into 1 minus x at the boundary, right on the boundary. And but this little point that's being little parcel of 1 minus x is being pressed hard up from behind by the x postulate, driving it from behind. Follow? So the effect is that the this little parcel of 1 minus x postulate and the little parcel of x postulates are going to be forced upon together, and you're going to get the bonding of x bracket 1 minus x end of bracket. Now that is going to happen on the x side of the boundary. Now, for exactly the same reasons on the 1 minus y side of the boundary, we're going to get little parcels up against, hard up against the boundary. We're going to get the 1 minus y postulate is being influenced by the x postulate on the other side of the boundary and is being driven into y. So we're going to get little tiny parcels of y postulate there, and little tiny parcels of 1 minus y postulate. They're going to be crushed together, forced together, and driven together into the common class of y bracket 1 minus y end of bracket. So on one side of the boundary, we're going to get the production of the little the postulate configuration x bracket 1 minus x end of bracket, and on the other side of the boundary, immediately facing it, right up against it, hard up against it, we're going to get the production of these postulate y bracket 1 minus y end of bracket. Now, we've already met this postulate configuration when we discussed insanity. We know what these are. We call them IPs. We have a name for them. Remember it? We know what they are. We met the beastie before. We met it on the previous tape. We met it when we were talking about insanity. So at the boundary between the opposition postulate, we see the formation of the two IPs of the Gauss package. On the x side, you see the x bracket 1 minus x end of bracket IP. On the y side, there's y bracket 1 minus y end of bracket IP. Those are two IPs form. So the postulate configuration at the actual boundary, what might be called the boundary condition, the conditions at the boundary, the boundary condition postulate is x bracket 1 minus x end of bracket plus y bracket 1 minus y end of bracket equals 1. It's what we, when we're discussing insanity, is what we call the twin IP situation. TIP. Remember the TIP? Twin impossibility points. TIP. TIP. So we have at the boundary, we have on the x side of the boundary, we have a continuous creation of these little x 1 minus x IPs. I'll drop the use of the word bracket again for convenience. We have the x 1 minus x IP on one side of the boundary being created, continuously created, masses of masses. Imagine them as little tiny parcels of this IP being created continuously on one side of the boundary. And on the other side of the boundary, there's a continuous creation of these y to 1 minus y IPs on the other side of the boundary. And that is all that's happening at the boundary. There's nothing else at the boundary. That's all that's there. There's nothing else that's there. There's just those four postulates, you see. Two postulates in the IP form on one side of the boundary, and two postulates in the IP form on the other side of the boundary. And they are the four postulates of the Gauss package. One side we've got x, 1 minus x. On the other side we've got y, 1 minus y. But they are the four postulates of the Gauss package, of the xy Gauss package. You see that? Now, what happens to these little IPs? Do they just sort of sit there? No, they don't. They merge. Now, to understand how they merge, we have to just pick out of our mass of confusion of these creation of these IPs at the boundary. We'll pick out one little parcel of x, 1 minus x IPs, and another little tiny parcel of y, 1 minus y IPs. So we've got two postulates in the IP state. We've got an x bonded to a 1 minus x. Then right by its side, imagine right by its side, we've got a y, 1 minus y IP. We've got a y bonded to a 1 minus y IP there. Now, can you imagine that? Now, put those postulates into a square. Put those postulates into a square. In the top left-hand corner of the square, you put the x postulate. Okay? Now, in the bottom left-hand corner of the square, put the 1 minus x postulate. On the top right-hand corner of the square, you put the y postulate. Now, on the bottom right-hand corner of the square, you put the 1 minus y postulate. Alright, now let's go to the left-hand corner of the square, to the x postulate, and let's see what the situation is regarding this little tiny x postulate on the top left-hand corner of the square. It's bonded to 1 minus y, which is the postulate at the bottom left-hand corner of the square. Okay? It's bonded to the 1 minus x at the bottom left-hand corner of the square, and that is the x 1 minus x IP. See, that's so bonded to its IP in the twin. But on the other side of on the top right-hand corner of the square, there is a y postulate. Now, x and y are complementary postulates. In this universe, they're complementary postulates, and they tend to attract each other. They have an attraction for each other, complementary, remember? But under the laws of postulates, what I gave you, that complementary postulates attract each other, merge and cancel each other out. Opposition postulates oppose each other and tend to fly apart and do not cancel each other out. That's the basic law of the canons of the postulates. The attraction and repulsion for each other. See them as rather like electric charges. So we have the x postulate and the 1 minus x in the top left-hand corner and 1 minus x in the bottom left-hand corner. They're bonded together, so they're pulling towards each other. We have the x and the y. That's the top left-hand corner and the top right-hand corner pulling towards each other because they are complementary postulates. They're trying to merge. But diagonally across the square from the x postulate, across the diagonal, is a 1 minus y postulate. Now, they're opposite. That's an opposition postulate. X and 1 minus y are opposition postulates, and they tend to fly apart. Okay? So they will repel each other. Now the 1 minus y, what I've said for x and 1 minus x is true for the y and 1 minus y. The y and the 1 minus y are bonded together. Top right hand corner and bottom right hand corner are bonded together. They're pulling towards each other and they form the IP y, 1 minus y. So, the Y is also attracted to the X postulate across the between the top right hand corner and the top left hand corner, but the bottom left hand, sorry, the bottom right hand corner is opposing the top left hand corner, and the top right hand corner is also in opposition to its opposition postulate, which is the 1 minus X postulate across the other diagonal. So you've got a square now. If you join the lines up in the square, all this join up the x, 1 minus y, and x, join the four lines up of the square to form the square, then join up the two diagonals, then put in your lines of false there between the various postulates, you'll see that x and y are pulling towards each other, x and 1 minus x are pulling towards each other, but across the diagonal, x and 1 minus y are flying apart. And this is true for each one of the four postulates in the configuration. So each postulate in each corner of the square is being acted on, is being pulled on by two postulates to merge, but it's prevented from merging because across the diagonal it's being repelled by the postulate across the diagonal. Now, if you were to take, say, the X postulate out, and take that postulate out and draw that up separately, the force is acting upon the X postulate by a little rearrangement of the forces acting upon the X postulate, you would realize that you would come to see that they form what is known in mechanics as a triangle of forces. That the forces, the little, you put the arrows in, you will see that there's the three forces are in equilibrium. Now, this is a little bit of high school mechanics, but nevertheless, it can be easily shown that the configuration is completely stable, and that the X postulate will stay right where it is. It's the balance of the force. In other words, it's at rest. It's got no impetus to move any place. It just sits there, the X postulate. And similarly with the 1 minus X postulate. Similarly with the Y postulate, with the 1 minus Y postulate. They form a square. The two IPs, in other words, come together and stick, with the X stuck to the Y, the 1 minus X stuck to the 1 minus Y, and the X stuck to the 1 to the 1 minus X, and the Y stuck to the 1 minus Y. But the X repelling the 1 minus Y, because they're opposition postulates, and the Y repelling the 1 minus X postulates, and those last two repulsions being across the diagonals of the square. And the whole thing is a stable configuration and will sit there in space. In other words, you can leave it there, and it has no intention to move any place. It's a completely stable configuration. Now, that stable configuration is the sensation, is the basic sensation at the boundary between the opposing postulates. What you perceive as the sensation consists of those four postulates in that configuration that I've just given to you. That's what the sensation is. It simply consists of those four postulates, those twin IPs stuck together into that configuration. And we call that configuration TIPM. M stands for mass, because that is what you perceive. You don't perceive it as postulates, you tend to perceive it as mass. So we call it TIPM, twin impossibility point mass, TIPM, and that is the technical name we use in TROM for a sensation, TIPM. We call it TIPM because that's exactly what it is. It's twin impossibility point mass. That's its exact anatomy. So TIPM is a much better name for it than the word sensation, which is a completely non-descriptive term. But TIPM is highly meaningful because we know what we're talking about when we talk about TIPM. Now, let us consider what we might call a single parcel of TIPM in this XY goals package, which is generated at the boundary between the X and the 1 minus Y postulate under the circumstances we've been discussing. We have the four postulates there. In the top left-hand corner we have X, in the bottom left-hand corner we have 1 minus X, in the top right-hand corner we have Y, and in the bottom right-hand corner we have 1 minus Y. And the forces between them are exactly as I've given, and we know that it's a stable postulate configuration in a stable balance of forces. Now, each one of these postulates, each one of those four postulates, is quite capable of attracting its complementary postulate exterior to this little parcel. Do you follow that? In other words, the X postulate that is bonded to the X postulate, say, in the little package, little parcel we're dealing with, although bonded to 1 minus X and attracting and stuck to its Y postulate, which it can't completely merge with, of course, but stuck to the Y postulate, is still quite capable of attracting the Y postulate from another parcel of TIPM nearby. And similarly, with the 1 minus X postulate in the bottom left-hand corner, is quite capable of attracting the 1 minus Y postulate from a nearby package of TIPM. And similarly, with the Y and the 1 minus Y postulates in the top right and the top and the bottom right-hand corner of our square. So each of the four postulates in this stable configuration is capable of attracting its complementary postulates external to the package, the little parcel that we're considering, in this whole mass of TIPM that is milling about and forming at the boundary, under the boundary conditions where these little parcels of TIPM are being constantly generated at the point of conflict between the opposing postulates. You see that? So the tendency will be for these little parcels of TIPM as they form to join up with each other, with the X joined up to the Y of another parcel of TIPM, and the 1 minus X joined up to the 1 minus Y, and the Y joined up to an X of another parcel, and the 1 minus Y joined up to the 1 minus X of another parcel, and so on. You see, all the bits join up by the attraction of the complementary postulates. That's what pulls them together. So the little squares will join up and form what we call a matrix. And you would see a matrix there. You could draw it out on a piece of paper if you wanted to. You simply take your basic square and put by the side of it another square and put in your lines of force there, and you would see the way they would join up, bearing in mind that the complementary postulates attract each other and the opposition postulates repel each other. So those forces would be sufficient to cause the whole mass of these little parcels of TIPM to form themselves into a matrix. Do you follow me? And so you wouldn't, at the boundary, we don't actually have a mass of little tiny, what you might call, parcels of TIPM. We have one lump. There's a tendency for the little parcels of TIPM as they form and are generated in gameplay to bond to the other particles and the whole thing to coalesce and become a mass of TIPM, a conglomerate of TIPM at the boundary between the opposing postulates. Now, Ron Hubbard, if you recall in Scientology, the early days of Scientology, if you recall the book 880, Ron wrote a book 880 on energy flows back in 1951, early 52, on the subject of energy flows, and he talked of flows and dispersals and ridges. And he said, when you get two energy flows crashing together, they form a ridge. Well, he'd spotted this phenomenon in his own psyche. And this, what Ron Hubbard called a ridge, was actually the boundary condition between the opposing postulates in the goals package. In other words, we're talking about the same phenomena that Ron had spotted back in 1951, when we're talking about TIPM. But Ron didn't know its anatomy. He hadn't got its anatomy out, because he didn't ever clearly isolate the goals packages like I have done with Tron. But he knew that when two flows crash together, that a ridge would form between them, and what he called an energy ridge. And that surrounding this energy ridge will be a dispersal of energy. You remember he talked of flows, dispersals and ridges. Well, I'll tell you where the dispersals fit in a moment. We'll get to those. We'll see how they fit in. And we'll see how accurate Ron was. He was tremendously accurate in his observations. But he just wasn't able to put it together in the form and to get the exact anatomy out like we can do it. He saw it as energy. He couldn't grasp that what he was looking at as energy wasn't really energy. It was a postulate configuration, which we called TIPM. Was the postulates in the IP state. He never got that far. But we've got that far, so we can analyse and get the complete anatomy of what Ron used to call a ridge, and what Ron used to call a flow. Well, a flow is simply the flow of the postulates, and where they crash together, it forms a ridge. Then we'll talk about the dispersal in the area of the ridge. So we're not talking about anything here which was not forecast, you might say, by Ron Hubbard back in the early days of Scientology, and I refer you to his book 880. Scientology 880, I think, if I remember the book was called. The subject of flows, dispersals and ridges. So at the boundary we see this mass, this conglomeration of TIPM, which will tend to form itself into a solid lump. In other words, this TIPM has an attraction for itself. In other words, the separate little parcels of TIPM have an attraction for each other. Left to their own devices, they will collapse on each other and form a mass. In other words, you could say that each particle or each little parcel of TIPM, and each parcel consists of the four postulates of the Gauss package in the postulate configuration I've described, that each little parcel would have a gravitational pull for the other particles. You follow? So the tendency for them, if left together in space, they would all collapse in on each other by the you might call it the gravitational pull of the complementary postulates involved. And so you would tend to see the collapse of the each little parcel, all these little parcels together. They might start as a confusion of particles or a confusion of parcels of TIPM, but they would soon collapse in on each other and sort themselves out and become a solid lump, a matrix. What we call a matrix of TIPM, which would be quite a uh, quite a fixed thing. It would, you know, you would have to pull it apart. It would tend to stick together because of gravitational, because of the attraction between the complementary postulates that were holding it together. It wouldn't, we no tendency for it to fly apart. It would have a cohesion because of the complementary postulates of which it contains, which consists of holding it together. You get that? So understand that cohesive nature of TIPM. It tends to have a gravitation attraction for other bits of TIPM. Just thought I'd mention that in passing. We'll discuss that aspect of it more later on. Well, so far we've talked about this barrier being stuck between games player A and games player B. Now we must discover what happens when one of those players starts to win the game. Because this is our, we can now move from the static situation that we've been discussing to the dynamic situation that we see in actual life, where one or other of the players starts to overwhelm the other player. Now what happens when this occurs is that the boundary starts to move towards the loser. He no longer is able to hold the boundary out there. His postulate is insufficient to hold the boundary in its position, and the boundary starts to move towards him. The TIPM is still being formed at the boundary, and as he progressively loses the game, the boundary comes in closer and closer and closer to him. Now, as this happens, he will go through a definite sequence of events. A definite sequence of events there, which you ought to know about. Actually, if you were to continue to do level 5 for long enough, you would discover all this material for yourself. You would discover all these events and all about boundaries and all about this TLPM for yourself. But it's necessary to understand it, to understand the phenomena that we're talking about, of just what happens as this boundary moves towards the person. Here he is, say, supposing X is the loser. He's losing the game. And this boundary of TIPM is moving relentlessly towards him as the opponent's 1 minus Y postulate proceeds to overwhelm him. The boundary gets closer and closer. Now, the sequence starts there. The first sign that he gets, he starts to come in under the influence of the boundary. He starts to get influenced by the boundary conditions in the game. Now, the first sign that he's becoming influenced by the boundary conditions in the game is that when he begins to sense the boundary gets so close to him that his own postulate begins to flip at random between its postulate and its negative. In other words, he's beginning to get right up close to the boundary now, and he's beginning to go into the boundary condition himself. So his X postulate starts to flip. It will flip his postulate. He can't hold his postulate in X. It flips over to 1 minus Y. Sorry, it flips over to 1 minus X. It gets driven into into overwhelm. He goes into 1 minus X. Then he hauls it back out again and gets it back onto X there and pushes on with the game there. Then at the moment later, his postulate snaps into 1 minus X. Then he snaps it back into 1 minus Y. And so at first this happens at random, and the emotional, the feeling that goes with this random snapping between the postulate X and its negative 1 minus X as he's influenced by the boundary conditions. You see, he's responding exactly like the little parcels of the X postulate responded. They were again being pushed backwards and forwards between the X and the 1 minus X. Well, now it's happening to the games player himself. Now, the emotion or the feeling, the sensation, well, no, it's not sensation, the feeling that goes with this is a feeling of confusion. He starts to feel confused. He goes to the feeling of confusion. Now, this is quite an important part of the proceedings, this confusion. We better understand what we mean when we say confusion and analyse the word itself. Now, the word confusion comes from the Latin fundere, means to pour. And the word confuse and the word confound, word confound comes from the Latin fundere, to pour, and the word confound and the word confuse mean much the same thing, to confound and to confuse. So, the word confuse in our language almost literally means to fuse with. No, it's an interesting word, isn't it, to fuse with. And we're talking about IPs, where postulates are being bonded to their negative and being fused together. It's a very, very interesting word, its derivation. It's almost as if someone, right along the line, sort of just picked this meaning, this idea of confusion, the idea of two things being bonded together. Nevertheless, that is exactly the feeling that the person gets as that IP barrier gets closer, TIPM barrier, I should say, moves up closer and closer to them. They go through a period of confusion where their postulate snaps backwards and forwards. They're in the X postulate and they keep snapping to 1 minus X, and they haul it back to X again, and they're holding X for a while, and then it'll snap over to 1 minus X, and they get it back to X, but it's random. It's not regular. It's random. It's confusion. Now, that feeling of confusion will intensify and then diminish. And as it diminishes, the barrier is now getting closer, it diminishes and the person goes into what is called a pulse reaction. They're now pulsing between the X postulate and the 1 minus X postulate regularly. They would be holding their postulate X, then 1 minus X, X, 1 minus X, X, 1 minus X. But it's not random, it's regular. It's a regular pulsation between the postulate and its negative. Now, this pulsation would get faster and faster to a certain point would be reached where the person is holding both postulates simultaneously. They're in X and 1 minus X. They're in both postulates simultaneously. They are in the IP, in other words. They're right in the IP. Now, at that point when they're right in the IT, it's a rest point. There's no confusion, there's no pulse. It's a rest point. There's a moment of stillness and motionlessness in there. It's a rest point there, right in the IP. Then they start to go out of the IP and start to go into the pulse again. They now go into the pulsation, a very, very fast pulsation of X, 1 minus X, X, 1 minus X, X, 1 minus X. In other words, they start to go out in reverse than the way they came into the IP. They go out first pulsing, X, 1 minus X, X, 1 minus X. Then random, 1 minus X, X, 1 minus X, X, and the feeling of confusion will return. Then there's less and less X's and more 1 minus X's until they're in just 1 minus X. Now they're in overwhelm. They've now, the effect, in other words, is to drive of the overwhelm, what we call an overwhelm, is to drive the person through the IP barrier. He gets literally driven through the barrier and out the other side. And the effect on his postulate is to change it from the postulate X on one side of the, as he goes into the IP, as he goes when he's on one side of the barrier, he gets driven through the barrier, and he comes out on the other side in overwhelm, holding the 1-x postulate. Now that sequence of events I've given you can happen in seconds, or it can take minutes, or it can take hours, but it happens in every overwhelm in games play. No exceptions. Doesn't matter what the postulates are, the person always, if he suffers an overwhelm, he goes through that sequence of events. He goes through the postulate, he has the barrier, first of all his postulate, he feels he's losing the game, the barrier gets closer and closer to him, he starts to feel confused, then he starts to pulse between the postulate and his negative postulate. Then he has this rest point of where there's no motion. Then he's out the other side, into the pulses again. Then he feels the confusion again. Then the confusion lessens, and he settles into the negative postulate. And the sequence is invariable, and it happens every time. In every game, every time he's ever lost every game in this universe, the being has gone through that sequence. Now, you might say, well, if that is so, how come it's not reported in therapy? How come that that patients, pre-clears in therapy, don't report it? But they do report it. Every time a person goes into an engram, a pain engram, they would always report confusion. If they get sufficient contact with the injury, sufficient contact with the impact, sufficient contact with the injury, that they will report some confusion. Well, what about this pulse? Why don't they report the pulse? Well, sometimes they do. I've known a pre-clear to feel and say that, well, I don't know, I seem to be sort of pulsing between things here, there, but it's, you know, and then the feeling's gone. And then there's a sort of calmness there, and then he's back in the confusion again. But the real reason why the person doesn't experience all of the steps in the action, in recall, is because the rational mind abhors the IP state. You see that? So he skids over it. He skids over the IP. The tendency is when you run an engram on a person or run a point of overwhelm, he'll pick up the point where he starts to lose the game. He'll feel the confusion, then he'll feel the impact, and then he'll be in the overwhelm. He'll go straight through the IP unknowingly because he abhors it. He just doesn't register it. The next thing, he's in postulate reversal, and his postulates got overwhelmed, and he didn't spot it. He didn't spot the IP, simply because the rational mind abhors the IP state, and so it won't duplicate it. But the rational mind can duplicate the confusion. So pre-clears, when you run an engram on a pre-clear, they almost invariably report some form of confusion. Sometimes they report the pulse, but that's rare. But they never report the stillness that would be right at the centre of the IP, because to experience that, they would have to experience pure insanity, and that they can't duplicate. They can't duplicate that. That's pure insanity that they went through. Now, what is the difference between the person going insane and the person going through an overwhelming games play? Well, there's only really one difference, that the person going insane never came out. You know, he had no, as I said, you know, he had no place to go, so he stuck in the IP. It was his last game, so he stuck in it. But your ordinary games player, being overwhelmed in games play, he will go through the IP barrier, come out the other side, simply because he got some place to go. He can come back out, and he does come back out. All he suffers is a postulate overwhelm. Now, there's another phenomenon that occurs that I haven't mentioned so far, because I didn't want to burden you too much all at once. But there's another phenomenon that occurs as the person starts to lose the game and have the barrier move towards him. So when he has the IP barrier move towards him, and this is that the game sensation which he's been sensing all the time. He's playing this game. He can sense this barrier there consists of IPs, and he senses it as sensation. Remember I said that? He doesn't sense it as, he sees it as mass, but he doesn't see it as IPs. He senses it as mass or as sensation. So he's sensing the game sensation there. And as the barrier moves towards him, the game sensation intensifies. It can be easily shown that the distance from the barrier, given that the postulate intensity is constant, that the intensity of sensation obeys the inverse square law in the universe. In other words, if the barrier is half the distance, the sensation is four times as strong. It's the inverse square law in the universe, that Newton's inverse square law of gravity. But anyway, that's only just an interesting point in passing. But nevertheless, that is the law that it obeys. That the closer he gets to that barrier, the intensity of the sensation he feels goes up according to that inverse square law. And this intensity of sensation increases, and reaches a very peak at the point where he goes into the IP, at which point it stops. Then when he comes out the other side, there's a peak sensation again, and then as he settles into the overwhelm, the barrier's gone and the sensation rapidly drops off to zero, because the game is ended now. He's in complementary postulates. Once he goes into the complementary postulates, goes through the rapid confusion on the other side of the barrier, and then complementary postulates, the game's ended and all the sensation ends. But the sensation peaks actually at the point where, just when he goes into the IP, just when he goes through the IP barrier, is the maximum point of sensation. Now, if you understand this about sensation and this relation between the IP barrier and sensation, you will understand something which has puzzled many, many researchers in the human mind, in the human psyche, which we now can explain. This factor of why it is that games players, and particularly compulsive games players, will put their sanity at risk in order to enjoy game sensation. And they do it time and time again. They will take enormous risks. They will put their life at risk in order to enjoy game sensation. What they're doing, they're pulling that barrier closer, and the IP barrier closer and closer and closer to them, in order to maximize the sensation. Remember the inverse square law: the closer that barrier is to them, the more sensation they're going to enjoy. But you see the danger that they're running themselves, that they can easily, if they're not careful, they can get stuck in that IP. See that? In which case they lose everything. The sensation's gone, their sanity's gone. And if the other side of the IP is death, it may be. You know, on one side of the IP they may be alive, but the negative postulate might be their death. So when they go through the IP and out the other side, they're dead. You see that? It can happen. You get certain types of postulate configurations, certain types of postulates. But nevertheless, we find the compulsive games player is, in order to generate and maximize game sensation, will pull himself as close as possible to the IP barrier in order to maximize his sensation. And he will often boast of this, of how close he can get to it. it's like adolescents in motor cars, you know, of how many of them can, how fast they can drive down a road at a brick wall and still be able to pull up in time before they crash into the wall, you know. It's that sort of it's that sort of activity, you know. It's how close they can get to the IP barrier. In other words, they're simply trying to maximise the thrill, maximise the sensation, maximise the game sensation, without either losing their life or their sanity. It's an fascinating phenomenon of games play, one that's been recorded and noticed by many students of philosophy and psychology and therapy and so forth, but none of them have ever been able to explain it. And for the first time in TROM, we can understand it, because we've got the anatomy of it. We can see it in terms of, exactly in terms of the postulates and the IP state, and we got all the bits involved, and we can see exactly how the person does it and why they do it. Once we know this relationship there, the intensity of the sensation is inversely proportional to the distance between himself and the IP barrier. Get it? You see, the games player is in an awful fix on this subject of game sensation. He can't mock it up. He can't create it. He can only generate it in games play. And every games player sooner or later realizes that this system of maximizing game sensation, he might not know it exactly in the way that we've got it described. We understand it in TROM. He doesn't see it as clearly as we see it, but he does know that by taking risks, he can maximise his game sensation. And it's the only way he knows how to generate the sensation. He can't do it any other way. He can't mock it up. He can't create it. So he has a love-hate relationship with this IP barrier, with this barrier there, that it attracts him like a moth to a flame. It's pure sensation, the barrier is, you see. But if like the moth with the flame, if the moth goes into the flame, he's a dead moth, he's gone. If the games player gets caught in the IP barrier, he goes in and gets right into the IP barrier, he's a gone games player, because his sanity's gone. At least his sanity's gone, and maybe his life has gone too. So there's the risks he takes, and there's the incredible fascination that the games player has on the subject of sensation. Get it? It's a love-hate relationship. He's attracted by it like the moth to the flame. He can't keep away from it. And he can't satisfy his craving by his own creativity, because he can't mock it up. It won't create. It's quite incredible. It won't create. It can only be generated. Now there's the inner datum, the inner secret, the inner button, the inner works of this subject of sensation and the craving of sensation and its effect in games play. But just as I'm saying, remember I said in when talking about insanity, that the IP state, when you come to experience it, come to examine it, is really a toothless tiger. That when you really get into it and learn how to handle it, it's a toothless tiger. It's the same with this subject of sensation. You work with level 5 in TROM, you work with the postulates, and you work with the IP state, understand where it fits in and so forth into games play, and get to know its anatomy and get to experience all of its parts and so forth. Again, you're dealing with the toothless tiger, and you reach a point eventually where you can you don't perceive the barrier as a mass. You perceive the barrier, the IP barrier, for what it is, a series of postulates in the IP configuration. And you know something interesting that happens at that point, case-wise, in level 5? The craving for sensation disappears. It's gone. It's gone. At the point where you know exactly what it is, and you know all about its complete anatomy, you've lost all desire for it. It's gone. It's gone. Get it? You might say it's only the mystery of it that keeps it's only the mystery of what sensation is that keeps attracting the games player, because he can't create it. At the point where he can create it, and he can't create it, of course, because he doesn't know what it is. But at the point in Tron where he reaches a case level in Tron where he can create it exactly and precisely, his need for it is gone. He's like the man who says, "Marvelous! I'll take up Tron, so I won't have to go to the brothel every Saturday night, and I'll be able to mock up sexual sensation." But at the exact point where he reaches his goal, he doesn't have any need to mock up sexual sensation, because he understands exactly what it is. He's got the whole posture configuration there, and it's gone. The whole thing's gone. The whole lot just falls apart. There's nothing there. The whole lot just evaporates into nothing. The craving's gone. To be replaced with knowingness and understanding. Now that's what happens in therapy on this subject. That's what happens. So when a person embarks upon level 5 of Tron, I said in the write-up, when a person embarks upon level 5, that it might change them into something different from human. They might not be what is normally regarded as human by the time they've finished it. Well, this is one of those aspects. Your attitude towards sensations and so forth is going to have a marked change. And you will find that instead of spending a large percentage of your life going around trying to generate game sensation, You can find other more interesting things to do with your time than wasting it trying to generate game sensation all the time, when you can simply understand the nature of this sensation. And so you lose interest in it, because you understand it. Now, I've just been replaying this tape so far, and I've realised that I mentioned this subject of confusion and dispersal. I mentioned Ron in 880 and flows, dispersals and ridges, and I said I'd tie up this subject of dispersal for you. Well, the subject of dispersal is the subject of confusion. It's a dispersal. What Ron meant by an energy dispersal is exactly matched by the person in a state of confusion when he's bouncing at random between a postulate and its negative. That's all confusion is, by the way. That's all. That is the anatomy of confusion. It's the random snapping between a postulate and its negative. That's all confusion is. You'll find that any confusion is that. That's all it is. This feeling of confusion is the random snapping between a postulate and its negative. You can take any confusion apart that way. That's all it consists of. There's nothing else there. There's nothing else in any confusion but the random snapping between a postulate and its negative. And that is the dispersal that Ron spoke about in 880. That's an energy dispersal. The feeling of confusion, the confusion is the dispersal. There isn't anything else there. That confusion and dispersal are synonyms. If you care to pick up the points in your life when you felt confused and re-experience them, you will then think of this feeling of dispersal, feeling dispersed, you'll find that it's exactly the same phenomena. There's no difference between the two phenomena. To feel dispersed is the same as feeling confused. There's no difference between them. A confusion is a dispersal, and a dispersal is a confusion. And the anatomy of confusion is the random snapping between a postulate and its negative. We now ought to take up the subject of the anatomy of, or not say the anatomy, but the qualities of this stuff called TIPM. What are its qualities? Well, we already know that the qualities of the IPs are, I gave four. Do you remember I gave the four qualities there of of the IP is identification, motionlessness, timelessness or time stop, and mass. Well, the TIPM, because it only consists of IPs, will also, of course, show these same four qualities. And we need to take these up in turn and look at them in more detail to understand the nature of this stuff called TIPM. Let us take up first the subject of identification. The TIPM consists of an identification between a postulate and its negative, and that is absolutely fundamental to the anatomy of TIPM. But look, an identification between a postulate and its negative is the very essence of irrationality. So, which tells you that TIPM is not a thing of reason. It's not rational. It's not a rational state. It's not a rational thing. TIPM. It's highly irrational. In fact, TIPM is as irrational as anything can get. It's not rational. Now, this tells you right away that because TIPM is irrational, it won't duplicate you. It won't adopt a complementary postulate with you. So you direct a postulate at it and order it to do something, and it won't do it. You order the TIPM to jump, and it will refuse to jump. It won't jump because it's not occupied. It's not operating. That's the correct word. It's not operating in a rational manner. So it simply will not duplicate any postulate directed at it. It will not adopt a complementary postulate to any postulate directed at it. So that's something you should know about TIPM. It's completely irrational in that respect. It won't obey your orders. Whatever order you direct at it, it will simply not comply. It won't comply with any order directed at it. Of course, by the same token, TIPM does not, by its nature, automatically oppose any postulates directed at it. Left to its own devices, it will just sit there, and it won't play games with you. It will just sit there. In other words, you direct to order it to jump, and it doesn't refuse to jump. It just sort of sits there, being its quiet, uncomplaining self. You get it? So it neither adopts a complementary postulate to a postulate directed at it, nor does it produce an opposition postulate to a postulate directed at it. It just sits there, being its quiet, uncomplaining self. That's TIPM.